A mass stabbing in Boise earlier this summer left the Treasure Valley reeling. It left many scars, some physical, some psychological, on our refugee community. Many refugees seek asylum in the United States, leaving war-torn countries to try and find a peaceful existence. But when something as vicious as a stabbing attack happens, it can leave devastating effects on an already vulnerable community. Our Amanda Peacher has more.
Fatima Aboud explains her wedding song to me. It's all queued up on her phone.
It's like welcoming Fatima in with the people. And they're just saying, like, come in and just get in your happiness with you and stuff.
Aboud's wedding was supposed to happen on July 1st. She had everything ready the night before. Lace and flowers on the table, trays and trays of baklava. But that evening, a transient man went on a stabbing rampage in her community. One three-year-old was killed. Eight others were hurt.
The woman that got stabbed in her neck was like our neighbor for like 4 years.
Some of the victims were invited to the wedding. Aboud and her fiancé, Awalid Abdullah, decided to postpone the ceremony.
We shouldn't celebrate while they're in the hospital, you know, suffering.
Both Aboud and Abdullah fled Iraq a few years ago. Back then, there was regular bombing and violence on the streets. Aboud's father was almost kidnapped twice. Aboud's mother, Gada Abdullah, explains it this way.
We left all the people that we know. Back then, every day, I was expecting bad news. It could be that our brother got killed or your sister kidnapped.
Many refugees have similar stories. So when violence happens in their new communities,
it's re-traumatizing.
April Masaryk is an assistant professor of psychological science at Boise State University.
And you get to your place of refuge only to find out that you may not be safe.
Take the current crisis at the border, where many families have been separated.
Parents and their children are fleeing from an unsafe situation. For young children who rely on adults to care for them, are separated from them, it basically removes a lifeline.
People react differently to stress, so Masaryk is careful not to make generalizations about refugees or immigrants.
Worst case scenario, really, is that they live a life with the effects of the trauma every day. So this could be depressive symptoms, anxiety, hypervigilance. It can also look like hostility or anger, acting out.
That stress can also create physical symptoms.
Like, I feel all my muscles, like, all my body is hurting.
That's Iraqi refugee Nida Jasm. She says the stabbing in Boise triggered past trauma.
For days, it's continue with me until I'm over it, you know? Which I think I'm not over it. Like, it's in the back of my head. Like, I come back whenever there's something triggered it, you know?
She gets flashbacks of the horror she fled from in Iraq. Car bombs behind you as you drive to work. Neighbors who disappear without a trace. Murders on the street right in front of you.
It's bring something bad to from the memory, because it's like people killing like this. Like, this is the way. Like, this take me back to what happened. Sorry. So I'm like, is this happening here now?
Boise police have said there's no evidence that the suspect was specifically targeting refugees. Jasm knows that, but there's still this question that haunts her.
It's a guy, he has problems, he has issues, and he starts killing people left and right. But in my head, I'm like, but why all of them refugees?
But Jasm still believes Boise is a safe and welcoming place. Awalid Abdullah agrees.
It says, like, a single action and from a single person. Boise stays like a very safe and like peaceful city.
Awalid is still looking forward to his future here, including his marriage to Fatima. Their wedding is now planned for November later this year. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher.
And joining me today to give us an update on these families is Julianne Donnelly-Zuhl and Megan Schwab. Both are with the International Refugee Committee. They have been working hand in hand with our refugee community. I want to welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
You know, Julianne, you and I chatted on the phone a little bit before, and you said, you know, one of the things sometimes people don't remember is how the trauma can be re-triggered. And one of those ways is things like a court appearance. And tomorrow, the suspect in this is scheduled for another court appearance. And that can re-traumatize the victims in some senses, correct?
Yes, and this is going to be a story that unfolds for months and months and possibly years to come. This is not a court process that is fast and is going to have many kind of spikes of repeated contact and remembrance in it.
And because of that, I mean, this people from this refugee community come from other countries where the legal system is different. And so sometimes their court proceedings are much different than ours. So it's not just a re-traumatization, but it is also having to teach them about our court system, correct? And sometimes why it takes so long.
Yes, definitely. And that's something that we identified very early on, you know, the week after the incident occurred, and began to work with the police department and began to work with the prosecutor's office and to wrap around our clients and try to explain not just what they will be facing and what to expect in the months and years to come, but also to help prepare them for, you know, some of the difficulties of, for example, once again, being in the same room, you know, as the man that inflicted this trauma and brought this to their doorstep. So it's been a huge learning curve in terms of understanding why our process is this way, why it takes so long in order to seek justice for someone that they see as we've already identified as the culprit.
But one of the things I think we need to touch on is that everyone grieves differently, and there is no right or wrong way to grieve. So tell me about some of the things that some of these families are doing to move through this process.
So I think something that's really beautiful is to see how families are creating processes of healing for themselves and for one another. Something that has been just really uplifting for me in this is that the firefighters made this beautiful memorial garden, and it's become a focal point for people to gather and support one another. There's been, from when Ruya passed to Awake, which Megan might share a little bit more about, an evening gathering of women and some men around this garden, sharing coffee, sharing sweets, seeing this moment that brings a little bit of joy, you know, smiles, jokes, comfort, touches, hugs, and also this moment that allows for the community to help everyone kind of reset their natural clock, right? This is a daily ritual. It's a part of waking. It is a part of ending the day, and then it is a part of sleeping. It's making the day seem normal again. And each of the different families has built something for themselves that's different and very unique to them. But it's been about their positive movement forward and not only about all of the pain.
And Megan, what's that been like to witness that? Because I think in our culture, sometimes, you know, I don't think we do the best about talking about grief in our country. So when you have these other cultures coming in, what's it like to see that process?
It's been a... it's been a learning curve for myself. It's been very humbling and it's been very moving, you know, as someone directly connected with the families and who cared for the victims. It's been wonderful to be able to be a part of that process, to come together with some of the victims who I'm close with and to watch how the women and in particular, but the whole community visits many of the victims day after day, how some speak to sympathizing in the grief, but how everyone always speaks to staying strong, to bolstering one another, to reminding them that they are not going to just be there in the days or the weeks after, but I think they understand there's long-term grieving to be done, but also closure and continuing to be there for those families, that door is not completely closed. The support continues. I was just at the 40-day, more of a celebration of life for the young one who passed on Saturday. And it was, I mean, gosh, it must have been dozens and dozens, if not over 100 people who came to be with the families and the victims, which is very different often, very antithetical, I think, to what America typically expects, what culturally we often do. In terms of expecting privacy, not to transgress or intrude. And how beautiful to be with so many people, so many dozens of people coming together. Women were cooking for weeks ahead of time in hot kitchens all together. That community spirit, and I think that feeling that staves off just even a little bit of the loneliness, to know that you're not alone and people are keeping an eye on you and staying with you, not just in the initial aftermath, but for, you know, the 40 days after and, of course, the months and years to come.
And that's what's interesting is because sometimes in our culture, you know, you have a funeral, you have a memorial, mm-hmm. and then everyone else moves on with their life. And mm-hmm. if you've ever grieved, you have these moments. But to mm-hmm. have a community come together and mark 40 days, that has to be really powerful.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. And I think that something that's really important for all of us in Boise as we wrap around the families, because we're certainly not alone in doing this, right? Mm-hmm. There's the school district, there's the police, there's a lot of community organizations that have stepped forward to help the families in one way or another. But the really, really important thing to do is to wrap around and support what folks are saying directly. This is how we want this experience to be for us, right? So like I mentioned, each of the families who suffered a loss has been very, very different. And I think continuing to listen is important. An example of that, we gathered together with a couple of mental health providers to have support groups regularly in the apartment complex. And what bubbled up out of the support groups was, people are still very concerned about ongoing physical safety, even mm-hmm. though the perpetrator mm-hmm. is in jail. It's just an anxiety that you can't make evaporate. So we are leveraging the Boise Police and a local karate studio, Boise Valley Kenpo, to teach self-defense classes. And it's not something that we levered in on top of the community saying, you know, you guys need this. It was instead something that percolated up organically from them. And we were very lucky to find people who are willing to step in. I will tell you, it's been pretty fun getting lists of terms interpreted for the class. Who knew we would be getting things like, you know, foot stomp and eye poke and...
Oh, in all different languages.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank both of you for coming in and talking to me today and getting us an update on this community and how the families are moving forward. My guest today, Julianne Donnelly-Zuhl and Megan Schwab with the International Refugee Committee. Thank you both for coming in today.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.